A jury verdict in Sacramento against the family's first group home that operated in Davis. This case goes back to an incident in 2013. Today on Insight, Joaquin Sapien updates the story. He's a reporter with ProPublica, and some of his findings were used in the trial. Another march is happening this weekend in Sacramento. Similar events are planned across the country. It's the March for Science. It happens on Earth Day, and we'll have details coming up. And do you need to be educated about wine to be able to talk about wine? Rick Cushman is a wine expert, but he says you certainly don't have to be like him. That's in our monthly Cushman by the Bottle conversation. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's coming up today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. A jury's verdict in Sacramento last week shocked the family of a teenager who had been sexually assaulted at a group home in Davis. The boy was 11 when the incident happened in 2013. The group home was run by EMQ Families First. It has since been closed. Joaquin Sapien is a reporter for ProPublica. He's covered problems at group homes across the country. Some of his findings about the group home in Davis were included in that Sacramento trial. Joaquin has talked with us about this story before. He's back on the phone from his office in New York. Hi, Joaquin. Glad to have you back on Insight.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Is this a case that you thought would end up in court and before a jury?
Well, I didn't fully expect that it would go all the way to trial, to be quite honest with you. It's a pretty rare thing to contest, but I was aware that the lawsuit had been filed some years ago and that EMQ Families First was not necessarily going to move toward settling. So it did, in fact, go to trial. And over the course of that six-week trial, the jury heard evidence from a range of witnesses, many of whom we had spoken to first, including psychologists, social workers, counselors, people who worked in this very chaotic home, who really struggled to care for both Deshaun Becton, who is the plaintiff in the case, and many of his peers who were leaving in large groups from the group home, who had gotten involved in violence and sexual assaults. And, you know, we spent many, many hours with a lot of these people, and it was satisfying to see them have a chance to talk about their experience in open court and to see how a jury responded to some of those some of their testimony with this large award.
Would you explain specifically what this case was about and why it did end up in the court?
So the case centers around the story of a boy named Deshaun Becton, who was 11 years old at the time of his 15-month stay at the home. And Deshaun had been adopted by two enormously dedicated parents when he was 3 years old. Prior to that, he had lived with half a dozen foster families. His mother herself was living in a group home around the time that she gave birth to him. And while they were very dedicated, they really struggled to tend to some of his behavioral health needs, which were very extreme. He had night terrors. He could be violent. He could exhaust even the most dedicated, you know, therapists and social workers that came in and teachers that came into the home to help the Bechtons. And so ultimately, with the encouragement of state and county officials, they chose to place him at this home in Davis, which was about an hour and a half north of where they lived, outside of Oakland. And initially, he progressed. He made some connections with people that worked in the home, and things seemed to be going, modestly well. And unfortunately, the group home encountered a range of financial problems. They wound up laying off essential on-call staff that were called in on an emergency basis to supervise the home when kids were acting out. And they were also told by the state that if they didn't dramatically reduce their reliance on what are known as restraints, which are these controversial holds used by group home staff to subdue troublesome children, that they might be in jeopardy of losing their license. So it was kind of this perfect storm of factors that led to this very intense, very chaotic, prolonged period where kids were leaving the campus in large groups. Many of them, some of them hitchhiked to different parts of the state. Some of them were living in local parks. And Deshaun, who was 11 years old at the time, but functioned at the level of a 4 or 5 year old, fell in with this group of kids, and he disappeared one night. And he was gone for several hours. And as it turned out, he was in a public bathroom where he was victimized by a peer at the home. And his parents weren't notified for some 24 hours after he left. And this was all happening at a point when, as I said, many kids were leaving at once, and the home was basically in a state of crisis. The police had been called hundreds of times to respond to different incidents there, and yet no one really meaningfully intervened. As it came out at the trial, there was people who were working at the home who were trying to inform upper levels of management that they were in dire straits and they really needed assistance, but it didn't really seem to register at the highest levels of this company or with the state regulators that, children could come to great harm. Ultimately, an 11-year-old girl was allegedly raped by two older boys at the facility at a local park around the same time as Deshaun's assault, and that is what finally triggered some serious action on the part of the Davis Police Department, who raided the facility, questioned all the children, and sort of precipitated the state's decision to revoke, or the state and the county's decision to revoke its license. So that's kind of the fallout. And the lawsuit went into great detail about everything that happened. It had the home's chief administrator testify, many of the psychologists testify, and say their part. And the jury responded by finding this company, EMQ Families First, which is one of the largest mental health providers in the state, guilty of neglect, fraud, intentional infliction of emotional distress, and awarded the Becton's damages in the amount of $4.55 million, and a separate punitive verdict, which is just meant to sort of deter the company from ever doing something like this again, $7.5 million, which was a pretty remarkable thing and really surprised the parents.
Yeah, in fact, what did the mom say to you after the trial was completed and the family learned about that award?
Well, she was blown away. I've spent a lot of time with Veronis, his adoptive mother, and she is the toughest, biggest, most caring, most generous, compassionate advocate you can kind of imagine for him. And they have really struggled to afford the right kind of care for him. She's a nurse. Her husband, Lamont, is a firefighter. And it's been difficult for them to really have any kind of say in the kind of treatment that they can get for their son. They've had to rely on the state. He's currently in a secure psychiatric facility in Utah, along with some other 900 California children who have been sent to Utah and other states for mental health treatment. And they're relieved that they can hopefully buy him the best treatment money can buy. It's possible that it's likely, in fact, that EMQ Families First will try and appeal, and this could be tied up in the courts for some time. But I think for them, just getting some acknowledgement from a jury and seeing all of this air out and finally getting some clarity as to what happened to their son during this really dramatic period has been as much of a relief as it can be.
Joaquin, this boy was obviously very young when this first happened, age 11, and he's still now 16, so technically considered a minor. Why is his name public? Why was it made public in the course of the trial?
Well, technically it wasn't. A lot of the proceedings people were welcome to attend the proceedings. A lot of the filings were sealed over the course of the trial. Got to know the Becktons very well over the course of months and months and months of reporting. And we actually went with Deshaun's mother to a home that he was staying at in Utah, where she decided to remove him because it looked like he may have suffered some abuse there. And because of that and their sort of trust in ProPublica, my organization, and in me, they felt, comfortable with us reporting on his story. And this settlement being a part of it, we wound up using his name and making it clear to folks what had happened to him there. And as they said in their statement, as his father said in his statement to the judge and jury, they felt that he has been a voice for thousands of other foster children who have had, enormous trouble in these kinds of group homes and other settings.
I do want to go back in time. When you first talked with us about this group home, it's almost 2 years to the day, in fact, you made some comments, Joaquin, and we're going to revisit them. You and I were talking about the placement and management of these types of kids with intense issues. And here's what you said at the time.
This is a immensely challenging problem that can crush even the most well-intentioned, spirited people. It's a very, very difficult population, and the facility was operating under rules that are very hard to follow and are very confusing.
You were talking at the time about types of kids that are at homes across the state and across the country. The rules you were talking about were specific to Davis, but in general, how much can rules for caring for this kind of population vary, not only from group home to group home, but from company to company and then state to state?
Well, at least in California, the regulations are fairly consistent, although they are perplexing. So what I was speaking to there had to do with two things. One is when a staffer is allowed to use one of these restraints, which I had mentioned before, are these physical holds that they use to subdue kids that are that can be in the throes of a psychotic episode and could be violent or might be in jeopardy of harming themselves or other people. And so it's really up to the staff to make this snap decision as to whether or not they should engage a kid in a restraint. And the restraints themselves can be traumatizing. You can imagine a young child being pinned against the floor or against a wall by a much larger adult while they're in crisis. It's not hard to feel a degree of sympathy for them and to imagine how terrifying that must be for a kid. And so it's not something that, people that work in these homes necessarily take lightly. A lot of people that I've talked to who are in these situations don't really want to do them, but they feel like they don't have a whole lot of choice. And really the training for alternatives has been pretty limited. And so what happened in Davis is that the state had cracked down on these folks and tried to get them to limit their reliance on these restraints, but the company didn't provide any kind of alternative training in terms of how to talk these kids down or help them in any other way. And then the second issue had to do with kids that were leaving the campus. So the important thing to remember here is that these are not locked facilities. Kids can walk off of these, technically just walk off at any time. Now, they're supposed to be under the supervision of the staff at all times, and so the staff should be, they had been instructed to shadow them and try and sort of persuade them to remain safe and come back onto the campus. Now, but what happened in Davis is that these kids were leaving in such large numbers, and there were so few staff to watch both the kids that were wandering off and the kids that were creating problems at the home, mm-hmm. that they were just completely overwhelmed and they just lost control of the place. So some of these regulations do vary from state to state. A lot of states have been, my colleague here, Heather Vogel, has written a great deal about how laws around restraints are changing in different states. You know, to my knowledge, in California, they haven't significantly changed. But, you know, these homes in general are under a lot of scrutiny right now, and many of them are closing. You know, the place in Davis was a 72-bed home for kids anywhere from 6 to 18 years old, which is a huge range. Mm-hmm. There's kids that came in from the juvenile justice system. There's kids that came in through the education system. There's kids that came in through foster care, kids that had bipolar disorder, kids that had ADD, you know, a wide, wide span of needs and issues. And the staff, even under the best of circumstances, really wasn't particularly well, you know, qualified or trained to help these kids. I mean, the home in Davis relied really heavily on college students, kids that were in school themselves and really not much older than the kids that they were looking after. So they pulled a lot of students out of UC Davis to be frontline staff to supervise, you know, by definition, some of the most troubled kids in the state. So even under relative, you know, tranquil periods, it was a hard job. And so when things metastasized, it became nearly impossible. And a lot of staff quit in frustration, and that, of course, made things even worse.
You're listening to Joaquin Sapien. He's a reporter for ProPublica. And I have two more questions, not a lot of time, but I want to get through 2 points, Joaquin. Number one, how is Deshaun Becton doing now in the Utah facility and at age 16?
I don't know all of the details of how he's doing. I was there at the time that his parents decided to remove him from another home in Utah, which erupted in a separate sex scandal shortly after he left. And I know that he didn't have a great time there. They put him in they had him placed in a facility outside of Salt Lake City with a lot of, you know, reservations and caution, and they've done their best to see him as frequently as they can, and they felt early on that he was progressing there as well. But I do know that during the trial, you know, Veronis shared with me that during the trial they were getting calls from the staff there saying that he wasn't doing particularly well, and that he had to be, you know, secluded from some of his peers at the home.
Meanwhile, let me get to the other question, and that is that this company, EMQ Families First, is still operating group homes, I understand, but not under the same name. Is that right?
Well, they recently changed their name to Uplift Family Services, and I believe they still have ties to a home that's in Los Gatos. I don't know a whole lot about what the conditions are there. The state as a whole, as many states are moving away from group homes as a way to care for kids with these kinds of issues. They're just widely regarded as a treatment form that doesn't work particularly well. And so the state is currently trying to limit stays for children in these group homes to short periods of time where they can then stabilize and move them into a less restrictive environment. So a lot of these homes throughout the state have been closing. Now, on paper, that really looks like a good thing, but in reality, there's not a whole lot of alternatives that have been put in place to kind of take the kids that used to end that were going into these group homes.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's part of a bigger effort by states to reform this whole system. Even Congress has looked at some of the same issues. But for that reason, I know your reporting will continue, and I want you to continue to check in with us, even in a broader sense than just the home in Davis.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to come on anytime.
We appreciate the update, and we'll talk to you again, Joaquin.
Okay, I hope so.
That is Joaquin Sapien, a reporter with ProPublica. We'll post a link to his latest story, and I think we'll post links to a number of others because, as I said, he's been reporting on this issue for a few years now, and that will all be at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. Listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Scientists in the Sacramento region and across the country, in fact, are going to show their solidarity this weekend. Saturday is Earth Day, and it's the March for Science Day. So people with a message about science and to some degree politics are going to be in the streets. Megan Fidel is the co-chair of the Sacramento March, and she's in the studio with me. Hi, Megan. Glad to have you on Insight.
Hi. Glad to be here.
So this march comes on the heels of the Tax Day March last weekend, and in January, the big women's marches across the country. And each of those had a message for the president. So is there a message for the president in these marches, and to what degree will Saturday be political?
Our message to the president and to everyone is that we support science, we support scientists, and we support evidence-based policymaking.
Taking it to the streets in a march form, that's something new, though, isn't it?
Well, we're in a new era. We're in an era that has deep cuts to the EPA threatened, that has names of scientists in particular who work on global climate change being requested on a personal level. This is a time when...
I know you're sorting your thoughts because this is a new role for you, isn't it?
It is. This is my first time organizing a political march.
And it happened because?
I attended the Women's March in Washington, D.C., and I came back inspired and also as worried as many people are about the new political climate. This was an opportunity for me to do something, and as soon as I was working on it, I felt much more energized.
Mm. We're hearing from so many people, Megan, who for some reason or another have gotten politically engaged or have gotten involved in a cause, and they're being much more assertive, energetic, committed than they were before. So when you describe being feeling better and being involved in the cause, what's your vision or goal in doing something science-related and civic-related?
Well, our goal is to put on a march that shows that science is a valued part of society, that scientists have an appropriate role in policymaking, and to support scientists themselves. It is also our goal to give people a chance to come together and celebrate their love for science and to send a message.
I used the word political earlier. Maybe I'll try partisan. Is it partisan in any way?
No. Good science and good evidence-based policy is not a partisan matter. There are science is a process that comes out with a good result, and policy that is based on this process and result is sure to be more effective and good policy and law. And that's not partisan. That is just a decision that everyone can make, that this is a valuable policy for informing, science is a valuable process for informing our laws.
Mm-hmm. Your background is science. That's your education, right?
Yes. Yes. In my day job, I work at the intersection of engineering and policy.
Okay. So science is important to you. How has it been to take on the role of organizing a march and be, I would guess, more public and more outspoken than you've ever been before?
It's been great. If any of you out there are thinking about stepping into political activism this way, I highly recommend it. I have met really involved and interesting and brilliant people who have chosen also to volunteer in this way. I have seen other organizations around town that I didn't know existed, and they are also inspiring. As a subjective experience, it's been really wonderful.
Is climate change an issue in particular for you and the Trump administration's approach to climate change? Has that been a particularly motivating factor?
For me, it is. There are other ones that motivate other people. There's health policy. There are any number of policy areas that are better informed by good science. For me, I have a young child, and climate change is very important to me.
Hmm. You're listening to Megan Fidel. She's co-chair of the March for Science Sacramento. And I mentioned that the marches are being held on Earth Day. There's obviously a parallel and a significance there. What does that mean for you?
What does it mean for me?
Would you have celebrated Earth Day otherwise?
I might have gone to Picnic Day.
Okay.
And I know that the next day at Southside Park, ECOS is having an Earth Day event, and I probably would have gone to that, too.
So instead, you've jumped in completely, helped to organize this march. Who do you think will be there on Saturday?
Oh, we are getting so much interest from so many people. There's scientists and there's science enthusiasts. There's people who just love science and want to be a part of a gathering of other people who love science. We're seeing groups from Placer County and El Dorado. We're hearing from people in Modesto. We're hearing students say they want to be there. It's been an amazing turnout and response.
So tell me a little bit about how the day will go. The gathering begins at Southside Park at 10 a.m.?
It does.
And there are activities if you're getting ready to assemble or
yes,
be there.
Yes, we'll have music and we'll have tabling at Southside Park in the morning.
Otherwise, you can be at the Capitol to wait because that's the trek for the walk.
Right. At noon, our march itself will leave and walk about a mile to the Capitol. There'll be a main stage near the Capitol at 9th and Capitol. And we'll have speeches by scientists and policymakers for a couple hours in the afternoon.
And there's an exploration zone, a fair going on, a lot of activities for families and kids.
At the afternoon in the Capitol, we'll have a kids' section, an exploration zone. We'll have food trucks as well.
It occurs to me that in doing this, maybe you've learned something about yourself, because I think you took yourself out of your comfort zone. Although to go to Washington and be part of the Women's March in Washington was a big step forward for you, wasn't it?
It was a big effort, but it was something I was comfortable doing before.
Okay, so then in taking on a leadership role like this, have you discovered something about yourself in any way?
Not especially. In my day job, I do a fair amount of facilitation of meetings, and I do a fair amount of organizing large conferences. So this wasn't particularly different. I would say to anyone out there that if you have organized anything with a lot of moving parts, you are also capable of organizing a political rally.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty inspiring. There was a discussion on NPR about rallies and big gatherings and the question of, is it a big success if a lot of people come, or is it a big success if your message somehow reverberates? And obviously the goal is to do both. But what would say to you that this march in Sacramento Saturday is successful?
To me, it would be successful if we throw a march that many people are comfortable at, that many people come to and feel reassured that they are in a crowd that also loves science and loves and wants science to be a basis for policy. It would be a success for me if all of the volunteers who worked on this effort with us, perhaps 20 or 30 of them, felt that they had gained skills and had learned more about how to do this, if they had the confidence to move into their next organizing with some of the background that this gave them. Those would all be marks of success for me. I imagine that there will also be press about the march itself, and that is going to be in tandem with all of the other marches in other cities and the one in D.C. This march itself is one piece of that, and I'm glad of it. Mm. But my marks of success are going to be how people feel at the rally. Did they feel that they can come out and do this more?
There's still focus on STEM and an emphasis on girls and women getting into the field. Who inspired you? Where did your interest in love and science come from?
Both my parents. My parents are both scientists. My mom is a statistician and my father is an acoustician. They've raised us to to notice the real world, to test hypotheses, to follow your data, and to love science.
Wow. So your influence on your youngster could be not only science, but activism, too, here.
I certainly hope so.
Megan, anything else to know about Saturday? It looks like the weather is going to cooperate, so it doesn't have to be a rain or shine situation. But anything else to say to people who might be considering whether to jump in or not?
Please do come. This is for scientists and science enthusiasts. If you love the natural world, if you love reality-based policymaking, if you are inspired and need a way to speak up, it will feel good to be out in the streets with other like-minded people.
Mm. Thanks so much. Good job. I think this was your first interview, wasn't it?
It was.
You did a great job, Megan. I'm glad you came in. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Good luck Saturday with your big event, too. And that is the March for Science in Sacramento happening, as Megan said, in tandem with marches that will be held across the country on Saturday morning. There's more information posted at capradio.org/insight. Megan Fidel is co-chair of the event. This is Insight on Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Steve Milne standing by with more news. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Beth. The suspect in the shooting deaths of three people in Fresno told his family there was a war going on between blacks and whites in America. Corey Ali Muhammad, a black man, is in custody and is expected to be charged with 4 counts of murder. He faces murder charges for killing 3 victims yesterday and a 25-year-old security guard last week. All the victims were white. Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer says the case is being treated as a hate crime and not an act of terrorism.
If in fact he's lashing out at white people, or white males in this case, then that would constitute a hate crime. And I can't get into the details of his statement, which causes me to say that we don't believe it's a terrorist act. We believe it is a hate crime.
Dyer says Muhammad was on federal probation until last September for distributing crack cocaine and possession of a firearm. Muhammad's social media accounts indicate that he went to school in Sacramento at Grant High School and Cosumnes River College. The case of Sean Thompson continues. He's the man facing felony charges for hitting former Sacramento Mayor Kevin Johnson in the face with a pie last September. A judge yesterday ordered Sacramento police to turn over pictures taken during and after the incident. Thompson's attorneys are also subpoenaing Johnson to testify at the trial. Thompson is an activist for homeless people. He says throwing the pie was intended as political theater and was not an assault. Trial is set to start next Thursday. Sacramento Sports Commission says the city will play host again to the first 2 rounds of the Division I men's NCAA basketball tournament in 2020. The same 2 rounds were played at Golden 1 Center last month. Sacramento will also play host to a number of cross-country championships beginning in 2018, including the finals of the Division II men's and women's cross-country races in 2019. All of the races will take place at the Hagen Oaks Golf Complex. And we could be seeing more rain and snow overnight. It'll be sunny today in the Sacramento area with highs around 70. But tonight, there's a 50% chance of rain. Less than a tenth of an inch is possible. And then tomorrow, back to mostly sunny skies with highs in the low 70s. And for the South Lake Tahoe area, sunny today with highs in the mid-50s. But tonight, there's an 80% chance of rain and snow showers with lows in the mid-30s. Tomorrow in the Sierra, a chance of morning snow showers, but otherwise, mostly sunny. Follow us on Twitter at Cap Radio News.
All right. Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Such a nice time of year to go wine tasting. The crowds are usually smaller, and you can see some beautiful spring scenery, even fields of wildflowers, depending on where you visit. Wine expert Rick Cushman visited us last week, and we focused on this question. Do we need to be educated about wine to talk about wine?
No, we do not. You know,
simple as that.
Yeah. Being educated about wine is really fun. I know lots of people, as the more they get into wine, the more they want to learn about everything from the grapes to the farming to the little tiny intricacies. The problem is it shouldn't feel like the only way you are allowed as a customer to buy the product is to go to class first, which is a pretty bad business model, actually. And it really comes from two sources. It comes from the industry itself, my folks, my people. It also comes from my other people, wine writers. You know, the wine media. And I think it's worse from the wine media. You know, and I keep seeing these stories like how to talk like a pro, or where they talk to sommeliers and they say, how do you educate your customer? And it's exactly backwards. Whether it's somebody comes into a wine shop or even worse, a restaurant, and they're not there for an education. I mean, wine drinkers go across the spectrum. I mean, they're just like food lovers. You know, people go in a restaurant, they want to know the details of the technique, and they want to know in Sacramento, which is one of the things I really like about this whole region, is that what a lot of us ask in Sacramento is where to come from. And so the job of a sommelier or a wine server or the, you know, the person in the store is to help them, make them have a better evening or make a better purchase.
I've been in the situation of really embarrassing myself if I tried to talk ahead of what I really knew.
Yeah.
Or didn't even know enough to ask the right question, which shouldn't even matter. But what about that when people try to talk like pros?
Well, see, the nice thing, Beth, is that you got it. You got right away that, like, I shouldn't be doing this. And it's a funny thing, because the thing about the pros is they don't talk like that. You know, I'm in the industry. I just judged State Fair Commercial, and then we just had the Home Winemakers Competition, of which I am the chief judge. So we had a whole lot of pros in those two rooms. And you know what? None of them talk the way people tell you they're supposed to talk. They'll, you know, they may deconstruct a glass of wine, but you know what they usually say if they like it? This is great, or this is delicious, or this is a beautiful wine. I mean, you know, that they're not, they don't do the on the nose, on the palate, it's a light straw color with a, you know, variation on the rim. I mean, that kind of thing. And so it's back to your question about, you know, what should you talk that way? Your job, whether you're going wine tasting or buying wine in a store or having dinner, is to have fun. Mm-hmm. You're not there to impress them. And we get the question a lot, actually, on our podcast, because we take a lot of questions. A lot of times we get the questions, what do I need to know to go wine tasting? What a silly question. I mean, you know, not silly people for asking it, but that's the wine industry's fault that makes people feel like they have to get educated to go wine tasting.
Well, you and I actually went a number of years ago,
yes,
to Amador County and did an entire conversation about that, an,
yeah,
interview about,
yeah,
that.
And basically we, yeah, stood there and they told us, so we didn't have to know anything.
We just had fun, right?
Yeah, right.
You're listening to wine expert Rick Cushman. He just mentioned his podcast, so Bottle Talk with Rick and Paul.
Yeah.
And in fact, you're going on location?
We are going to be on location. We're going to be at Amador Four Fires Saturday, May 6th. That's in a couple of weeks. Amador Four Fires is this really great festival. What they do is it's a lot of open fire cooking, and it tries to highlight the four different regions that our foothill grapes come from. And that's really not just Amador. It's really sort of our entire region. Mm. So one of them is the Iberian Peninsula, Spain and Portugal. And it's so Spanish grapes like Tempranillo. Another is Italy, of course, you know, and grapes like Sangiovese, and really even, you know, Zinfandel's cousins like Primitivo. Another is France, because everything comes from France, but it's really the grapes like Syrah. And then California. You know, Zinfandel is really it's not a California native, but it's really identified with California. And so they're grouped by, and this is why it's really good for regular folk, they're grouped by the grape rather than by the winery. So one winery will be in each of those four regions, for example. So if you want to decide if you like Syrah, you go over to the French region and you taste a few of them, and you can start to really identify, do I like this wine? If I like a few of them, and then why do I like those few? If I don't like any of them, okay, now you know something. Syrah's not your wine. And so that's what makes it really fun. And then they have food pairings that go with each of those wines. Then we're doing a show in the middle of the day. So we're going to do it live, and we'll be taking questions from the audience.
Oh, great. And so, again, that's Saturday, May 6th.
Saturday, May 6th, yeah.
All right. Well, let's get back to how we talk about wine. And there were some questions that were asked of a bunch of sommeliers.
Yes. Yes.
And I think this speaks exactly to what we're talking about.
Yes.
So let me throw out one of the first questions. How do you find out your guest's wine knowledge?
Right.
Wait, does a sommelier need to know that?
Right. How about you go the other way around? He says, what can I help you with?
There
you know,
you
that's
go.
Your question. You know, can I help you with your wine? Are you doing okay? Are you, you know, I was at a very nice restaurant not so long ago, and the sommelier was great. You know, he brought the wine. Actually, we ordered. I was with a couple of wine people and a couple of non-wine people. And, of course, you know, we try to get the non-wine people to order because we like them to choose. They threw it back at us. But we, you know, picked a couple of wines for the group. And the sommelier was really nice. And I don't know whether it was that's how he always is. But what he did, he brought them. He opened it. He said, hi, can I help you with anything? You guys need an ice bucket? What? You know, just let me know. And moved off. It wasn't. He didn't try to oversell anything, you know.
But sommelier is a certification that
yes.
comes from a certain level of knowledge and being tested and earning that credential.
True.
So maybe built into that is the idea that as a sommelier, you have a responsibility to teach as well.
Well, you know what's funny about this, and I've talked about this in the past. I have some friends who are master somms, and there aren't many in the world. There are not 300. It's like 250 or something, you know. And I have friends that are master somms because I've gone through those trainings and because they're friends of my friends, and most of them really don't have any respect for me, and which makes me respect them even more. But all of them are very, very big on service. But what they all say is the problem sometimes is as people go through the training it starts is it's about, you know, analyzing wine and talking about service, and it always looks like all the things you can do wrong. And if you've ever seen the movie Somm, or there was a really horrible show Uncorked, which I went Uncorked on about a year ago.
Yeah.
You know, it made it look like there's all these things you could do wrong with wine. And what happens in that Somm training, it's almost not till the end that they really sort of get hammered into them this point that it's hospitality first, wine service perfection second.
Mm.
You know, and so sometimes a lot of folks on the way up, and then, you know, lots of folks can call themselves a sommelier just by, you know, I mean, it isn't, you don't have to, nobody's going to come in and beat you up if you say that. In fact, there was a water sommelier. I think we talked about that once, right? Yeah.
Yes,
somebody called themselves a water sommelier.
Right.
So, but what happens with the good sommeliers is that they are trained that service comes first. And then all this wine hoop-de-doo is second.
These questions then were on a popular wine and drink blog. Questions like, how do you teach your guests?
Right.
Oh, ouch. What do you instruct them to do about your wine list? How do you change their minds and get them to try something new?
I hate that one, Beth. That's the one that I really hate. And there was a question right after that, which is the same thing, is can you convince your guests they shouldn't always be drinking Chardonnay or Cabernet? So here are those two questions that assume that the customer is wrong for liking the wines that they like.
Or that the sommelier is really in charge.
Right. And and they don't do that with food. You know, somebody doesn't go in and say, you know, I'll have the chicken. And they go, no, you want the beef.
Why was it that you were going to order
yes,
chicken again?
Don't you know nobody gets chicken anymore? You know, we don't do that. So why is it that we're supposed to do that with wine? You know, my fundamental rule besides wear dark colors is if you love it, you're right. If you hate it, you're right. And that should also be the fundamental rule for every sommelier and every wine person, which is to help their customers get something they like and not get something they don't like.
It's just never wrong to try to make someone else feel special or important or taken care of. And when it comes to wine, it's part of the fun.
And, you know, if I can get back to these questions that we're talking about, is they came from an allegedly consumer-friendly wine site. It's a young one. And so part of the problem is that lots of people in the wine business think they're supposed to behave this way, because, quote unquote, their elders, the people ahead of them in the wine business, behave this way. That we all talk this way, or lots of young people getting in the business talk this way because the people they're working for talk that way and the people they worked for talk that way. And, you know, that's where, you know, if you're a customer, the only thing I can say is just don't get sucked into this. Don't feel like you need to talk like a pro. Remember that you're there to have a nice time, and the psalm can help you a lot. And all you have to do is say, you know, I'm going to have this wine. Or if you don't know, say, this is what I like, and what can you get me that's like that?
Rick, this was good to have this conversation. I like where you took it.
Thank you.
So, thanks so much for joining us this month.
As you know, always a pleasure.
And that was wine expert Rick Cushman. He does join us every month for Cushman by the Bottle. He mentioned this, but I'll mention it again. He will be at Amador Four Fires on May 6th. And you can find a link to his podcast, Bottle Talk with Rick and Paul, at capradio.org/insight. And that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruriak. Our senior producer is Jen Picard. Our producers are Chris Remington and Cody Drabble. Our digital team includes Marnette Federis and Jonathan Iestis. Our technical director is Mark Jones. We had help today from Caitlin Flaws. And Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. We're back with another live show tomorrow. Thanks for joining us.